This is the New York Times Magazine for Sunday, the 20th of October, and this is Dave Abbott. First up is Screenland, Total Eclipse, the response to a viral image of Greta Thunberg at the United Nations isn't just about climate change, it's about America's exhaustion with finding the same elephant in every room. This by Jody Rosen. Every now and then, the internet coughs up a viral video that has the quality of found art. It may be jittery amateur iPhone footage. It may be a spontaneous moment captured by a pool photographer covering a news event. But it has the elegance and integrity and uncanny formal symmetry of something scripted. One remarkable example is a recent video of the teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg, shot at the United Nations in New York on the morning of September 23rd. The clip begins with Thunberg standing at the edge of a lobby crowded with onlookers and reporters. The camera is tightly focused on her face, and we watch that face transform. Thunberg's eyes narrow and harden. Her mouth twists into a skeptical scowl. Suddenly, the camera whizzes back to reveal the object of her glare. President Trump has entered the room. He is flanked by aides and dignitaries, and his mouth is moving rapidly, as it often does. But what seizes our attention is Trump's imposing physical presence in the foreground of the shot. We watch him move with an imperious rhinocerine trudge into the center of the frame until he obscures our view of Thunberg almost altogether. The sequence lasts only a few seconds, but it is a complete narrative, a story told so deftly, with such faithfulness to Aristotelian dramatic principles and so sure a command of cinematic cliches, that it's hard to believe that it wasn't cooked up in Hollywood. The blocking, the beats, the zipping camera movement, and especially the exaggerated actions and reactions of the protagonists, all seem designed to heighten the drama and to underscore for anyone who may have missed the point that we are witnessing a stark morality play. The episode even had a foreshadowing prologue. That morning, in a speech to the world leaders gathered at the UN Climate Change Summit, Thunberg delivered a warning. "My message is that we'll be watching you," she said. "The eyes of all future generations are upon you." And there she was, not long afterward, fixing the planet's most notorious climate change denier with what the internet quickly deemed a death stare. The video rocketed around the internet, generating memes and quips, none of them especially clever. "Make America Greta again." This Greta Thunberg stare down is life goals. Find yourself someone who looks upon your worst enemy the way Greta Thunberg looks at Trump. Julian Castro, the Democratic presidential candidate, tweeted out the GIF under the caption, "I think a lot of us can relate." The eagerness of so many to claim Thunberg as their glowering proxy was curious. That withering death stare was directed at Trump, but was it directed only at Trump? Thunberg's message, reiterated that day in her speech at the UN, is a broad generational indictment that spares no one, at least no one over 18, for their empty words and inaction on the climate crisis. The countless thousands who have crammed social media feeds with variations on the theme, "We are all Greta Thunberg," are seeking an absolution that Thunberg is not offering. In fact, the viral popularity of this video may have little to do with climate change or with the scouring power of Thunberg's gaze. The clip concisely encapsulates an experience to which, as Castro suggests, millions of us can relate. The key moment comes with that abrupt shift in focal point when the camera seems to jump up and flee, zooming away from Thunberg to document the arrival of the president. It is a jarring bait and switch, a visual joke with a grim punchline. Thunberg is a small person, but a mighty moral force. Trump, it seems fair to assert, is in both respects Thunberg's antithesis. Yet the camera is drawn away and Thunberg recedes from view, her sharp features and bright magenta blouse reduced to indistinct blotches. She is eclipsed by the person of Trump, who heaves into the center of the frame like one of those giant cruise ships that arrive in the harbor to blot out the sun. Famous, powerful people are known to make grand entrances. It is part of the gig. But Trump's way of lurching into a room is inseparable from his propensity for creating chaos and obliterating meaning.
"Thank you very much. Thank you very much," he booms as he steps into the UN lobby.
He seems to be addressing this thanks to everyone in the room, as if all those presents have just burst into applause. They haven't. He's merely being Trump, doing what he does when he shows up any place, whether it's a meeting of the Group of Seven or a wreath-laying commemoration at Arlington National Cemetery or a Super Bowl party at Mar-a-Lago, subjugating the entire purpose of the event to his own ego and id. It is a demeanor that announces that if anything is going to get done today, it will happen in spite, probably in defiance, of the President of the United States. Trump wound up attending the climate meeting for about 15 minutes. There were more pressing matters to attend to. He posted on Twitter a dozen times that day, including tweets mocking Mitt Romney, Joe Biden, and Adam Schiff. He also directed a trolling tweet at Thunberg. "She seems like a very happy young girl looking forward to a bright and wonderful future. So nice to see." We are not all Greta Thunberg, but all of us know what it's like to be ambushed by Donald Trump. He pops up on your social media feed with hateful words and impulsive policy announcements. He flickers on TV screens and bus terminals and airport departure lounges, forever looming over your shoulder. He barges unbidden into your dreams. It is a condition of being alive in America in 2019. No matter who you are or what you're trying to accomplish, whether you're a 16-year-old working to save the planet or an ordinary citizen trying to make it through the day with some peace of mind intact, you will inevitably confront the specter of Trump, drifting into the frame in a cloud of disorder and bad vibes. Even the president's most dedicated enablers scan the sky warily, awaiting today's cyclone, the next reckless, capricious twist of the plot. The door swings open, the president enters, all heads turn, the camera whips around, and suddenly everything else, better angels, higher ideals, common decency, common sense, beauty, truth, blurs into the background. Next up, a diagnosis by Lisa Sanders. The man was covered with an unbearably itchy rash, but dermatologic tests did not turn up anything, so what was it? "I feel like my body has been taken over by aliens," the thin 82-year-old man exclaimed. Dr. Melissa Iammetteo, I doubt if I pronounced that correctly, it's spelled I-A-M-M-A-T-T-E-O, Iammetteo, the chief of allergy and immunology at WestMed Medical Group in Purchase, New York, nodded sympathetically. This was her first appointment with the older man, who had come to discuss the itchy rash that had made his life unbearable. At his age, he told the doctor, he'd been through a lot: heart disease, chronic kidney disease, gout, But this was a whole new ball game. For the past several years, he told the doctor, he had had sensitive skin, thin with age, easily injured, but about 6 months earlier, he began to itch like crazy. It started with a rash. Big red blotches suddenly appeared on his chest, belly, backside, and thighs. Right from day one, they were unbelievably itchy. He couldn't sleep, could barely read or think. He went to see one dermatologist after another. They'd taken biopsies and sent him for blood work. He was treated with steroid creams, first strong, then stronger. They didn't help. Then UV light therapy. After 20 treatments, he gave up on that too. The last dermatologist thought he might have scabies, tiny mites barely visible to the naked eye that live on the body and cause intense itching, or pruritus. But despite two courses of a total body insecticide cream, the man was still scratching himself raw. The last dermatologist he saw began to suspect that perhaps it was a skin manifestation of a disease somewhere else in the body. Two biopsies showed the presence of eosinophils in his skin. Eos, as they are known more familiarly, are a type of white blood cell that can be seen in eczema or other allergic reactions. This rash clearly was not eczema. None of the usually effective treatments for eczema had worked. The itch of scabies is also an allergic reaction, but getting rid of the mites ends the itch, so it wasn't scabies. He was probably allergic to something, but it wasn't clear what. She sent the patient to Yamateo, an allergy specialist. Yamateo was well known for her extraordinary ability to figure out tough cases, even when they weren't caused by allergies. The night before her appointment with the itchy man, Yamateo pored over the patient's medical records, as was her practice, to try to get a sense of what might be going on. In reviewing the man's chart, she noticed that in addition to EOs in his skin, the patient had an overabundance of EOs in his blood, more than three times the number normally seen in circulating blood. Allergies did not cause those kinds of numbers. What, then, could cause that kind of cell to proliferate? Generally, the number one job of EOs in the body is to fight off parasites. In the U.S., one of the most common parasites is Toxocara, which is transmitted from the feces of infected dogs and cats. Strongyloides, another parasite, has been found in people who have spent time in tropical or subtropical regions where it is endemic. Both can cause a rash like this, so either was possible. More concerning in a patient at this age was a malignancy or a syndrome of hypereosinophilia, a disease in which this type of white blood cell begins to proliferate wildly. She saw the man early the next day. He was chatty, but even as he told his story, he couldn't stop scratching. It turned out that he'd had a cat that was old and sick, and his half-brother had two dogs and four cats that he'd recently spent some time with. So toxocariasis certainly was possible. He had visited the Caribbean many times, though not recently. Still, that meant strongyloidiasis was also a potential culprit. Besides the itch and the sleep deprivation it caused, he had no other complaints. On examination, the man's body was covered with well-defined, red, inflamed patches on his chest, back, buttocks, and thighs that were crisscrossed with scratch marks. In some areas, the skin was thick, leathery, and lumpy from the rash and the skin's response to persistent scratching or rubbing. Other areas were covered with tiny flakes of scaling skin. When the patient was dressed, Yamateo returned to the examination room. She didn't think this was an allergy, she told him, but it could be a parasite. She thought it was more likely Toxocara, given his recent exposures to dogs and cats. Toxocara is a type of parasite called a nematode, or roundworm. It lives in the gastrointestinal tract of dogs and cats. Until the end of the 20th century, visceral toxocariasis could be diagnosed only by the symptoms it caused when it invaded the organs of the body, the liver, the lungs, the brain, or the eyes. These were serious infections, causing everything from wheezing and shortness of breath to blindness, or rarely, death. It wasn't until a diagnostic blood test was developed that other manifestations of the disease were identified. In what's called common toxocariasis, patients have gastrointestinal symptoms as well as an itchy rash. In covert toxocariasis, the only symptom is an itchy rash. These infections often resolve on their own over time, but they can also be treated with the medicine. This patient could have covert toxocariasis. Yamateo said she would test for both toxocariasis and strongyloidiasis. She could also refer him to a hematologist to look for a malignancy or other trigger that might have caused his overproliferation of white blood cells. There were other causes of this rash and eosinophilia, but these were the most likely and a good place to start. A few days later, she got a possible answer and called the patient. "You probably have toxocariasis," she told him. The blood test came back positive, but she explained there was a caveat. The test measures whether the immune system has responded to this particular parasite ever. The fact that it was positive meant that the patient had been exposed to the parasite, but it could not determine when the exposure occurred. Toxocara infections are most common in children, but the test will still be positive, even if the infection is long gone. The only way to know for certain that the toxocara was causing the itch, she told him, was to treat him and see how he responded. She referred him to an infectious disease doctor who prescribed the recommended 5 days of albendazole. Albendazole? Because he couldn't know for sure if this was the right diagnosis, the patient kept his appointment with the hematologist. That doctor sent off more blood to look for signs that the overabundance of these cells could be caused by an eosinophil gone wild. But well before those test results came back negative, the patient felt that he had his answer. Within days of completing his treatment with albendazole, the itching resolved. And by the time he went back to see Yamateo 2 weeks later, even the rash had mostly disappeared. Why had Yamateo been able to figure this out when other doctors couldn't? The patient asked when he saw her for a follow-up visit. She explained that she had gone to Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx, and one professor there was an expert in parasitology. She took her class, and what she learned stuck with her. Different medical schools have different strengths, she told me later. Parasites were one of them. And, she added, doctors are taught that toxocara infection is rare. But now she's not so sure. Since making this patient's diagnosis last spring, she told me she has diagnosed nearly a dozen cases of toxocariasis in patients whom she might not have thought to test for the parasite, if not for this older man and his rash. I know I've been successfully diagnosing it more of it because, well, it's on my mind. Next, a tip on how to pick up a syringe. No exposed flesh, says Maya Ogbebor, a syringe disposal program manager for the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, which runs a 12-person, 12-hour a day, 7-day-a-week needle pickup crew funded by the city's public health department. Since the program started in June 2018, the team has collected 275,000 used syringes left by IV drug users in gutters and doorways, jammed in car tires, and even stuck birthday candle-like in feces. Wear long pants, covered shoes, and latex gloves to fetch needles. Never use your bare hands. Carry a trash picker or tongs and a medical-grade sharps container. If you spot a used syringe, place your container on the flat ground, grasp the needle with your picker, and then push it into the sharps bin needle size side first. You'll get better at spotting syringes with practice. You develop an eye, Ogbibor says. Many, but not all, have a telltale bright orange cap. Check under bushes and shrubs. Untrained citizens should leave syringes alone and report them to city officials. Ogbibor's crew tries to respond to such reports in less than an hour. Never allow someone to pass you a syringe. Instead, request that it be put on the ground so that you can follow safe pickup protocol. Stay courteous. You're not there to judge. We ask people, is it okay if we pick up this syringe? Ogbibor says. Carry a stick kit in case of an accidental poke. If that happens, squeeze a few drops of blood from the wound, clean it with an antibacterial wipe, pour saline solution over it, bandage it, and go to the hospital. Don't exceed your container's fill line. Used syringes are hazardous medical waste and should be disposed of accordingly. Never put them in the garbage. Prepare to find more at the beginning of the month than at the end. That's when people get paid, says Ogbibor, whose team uses an app to mark where and when they find needles in order to create a detritus pattern map of the city's estimated 22,500 injecting drug users. Know that you will be out among them and may be called upon to help. Her team members go out in pairs, carrying Narcan, a drug used to revive those overdosing on opioids. We see overdoses, Ogbibor says. We see people who have died. Next, a poem selected by Naomi Shihab Nye. One of poetry's most appealing elements can be its mixture of observations. How do these things go together, someone might ask. David Rondvet's poems in Dilemmas of the Angels often contain a tangible moment or two, and then something startling or surprising drops in. These poems of layering counterpoint feel a lot like the world, a person standing on a street corner watching others move by, each in his or her own universe. And then there are the plants and the ants and the birds and the machines and objects that give people the gravity and the intentions. Where will the people pause next? Why did the birds fly too soon? And so, Taking Leave by David Rondvet. They no longer come to my door, but I see them on the street. These young men who travel together in black slacks and white shirts, name tags announcing them as elders. I watch them pass on their bicycles, also black, with backpack straps flapping, wings working hard but too small. This morning, I found two robins, nestlings who leapt too soon and fell, or were dragged from their home nearly featherless, with ants in their empty eyes. so that as the bicycles disappear down the street, I grow younger and younger, a child on tiptoe, waving at those who go before me into the world. Next, some bonus advice from the ethicist, this Judge John Hodgman. He's not a real judge. He's a comedian. Evangeline writes, I currently live with my boyfriend, Nate. We have had an ongoing argument about the toilet seat. He believes that he should not put the seat down after he uses the toilet. I, on the other hand, believe it is the man's responsibility to put the toilet seat down after he uses it. To this day, we still cannot agree as to who is right, who is wrong. He still leaves the seat up, and it still drives me nuts. Please help. Response from John Hodgman. I came close to throwing this letter away, as I thought it was a joke. Surely Nate must know how long this battle has been fought, what an ancient, stale staple of relationship humor it is, and how solidly the law has been settled in this regard, but I guess not, so I say it now. Nate, and all men everywhere, put the seat down. And while I rarely go this far, I would advise you to cease sharing a toilet if Nate does not comply. Clichés make terrible life partners. Next up, I was born without a left hand. I have been on the receiving end of a lot of perhaps unintentional but ultimately unethical behavior, but I am a realist and I accept that being a unique individual means I have unique experiences. Besides the stares, the questions, and grappling with the tendency of those around me to simultaneously over and underestimate me, something odd happens to me on a regular basis. I guess I'd like to permission to let it slide. It's not my problem. It's not my fault. I don't want to steal, but I hate having to go back to fix somebody else's mistake, especially someone who felt intrusive, unkind, and rude. In the usual course of things, when a store has made a large mistake, it would be inappropriate to offer to pay the difference, but when the amount is small, the store isn't entitled to your inconveniencing yourself, especially given that it was the store's fault, not yours. The larger the amount, the more reason you have to get in touch. But what if, as you suspect, this isn't the usual course of things? You think you've been undercharged because the cashier was disturbed by your missing hand, and you wonder if it affects your obligations. You're making a conjecture. Undercharging can sometimes be an ordinary slip-up, and if you've become attentive to it, you'll simply notice its occurrences more than others would. You raise the possibility the cashiers are doing it intentionally, not randomly, because they're distracted by your absent hand. I wonder how plausible this scenario is, but let's explore it, because it poses ethically interesting issues. There is a further distinction to be drawn. Sometimes cashiers take pity on you, doing you what they regard as a favor, don't expect you to notice. And it isn't your duty to set them right. So long as the sums are relatively small, you can indeed let the mistake slide, availing yourself of the same right any other customer has. That's all my time for today. This is Dave Abbott, and this has been the New York Times Magazine. Thanks so much for listening.